Well, thanks, Scott. So that's kind of a taste of the first half of the book, the theory half. And the book kind of weaves theory and methods together. I'm going to give you a taste of kind of the second half of the book, if you want to think it that way, about methods. And part of what we're trying to do is we're really trying to elevate the standard expected quality of the studies evaluating the public health effects of law. So I'm going to give you kind of a breezy overview of one of the chapters in that part of the book. I have nothing to disclose. So when we think about science, so now we're shifting just a little bit just to basic science, right? When we evaluate anything, any new drug, any new treatment or anything, the issue what we want to create, of course, is the counterfactual, right? This is all back to our first level research methods class. The counterfactual is the comparison. We need to have a set of people that are exposed to a new treatment. In this case, we're talking about the new treatment as a new law. And then we need the exact same set of people at the exact same point in time, in the exact same circumstances, settings, and situations, to not be exposed to the treatment. And then compare the two to find the treatment effect, right? That's the counterfactual. So a lot about research design is to get the best approximation of that counterfactual that's possible. Well, one thing that made a huge advance in science, of course, is the whole notion of random assignment. Random assignment, if you have a new treatment and you take a pool of subjects and randomly assign half of them to get the treatment and half not to get the treatment, it doesn't guarantee that that experiment is going to work in the sense that those two groups are equal. But what it does ensure is over the long run, if you do that experiment 100 times or 1,000 times, on average, they're equal. There's no bias. They're equal. So that was a major advance. And before I move off this, I think that we in public health law research can do a lot more to push this notion of randomization. So we can see it happen. We tend to discard it right away, but you can see, like in the UK, they're rolling out new laws, changes in regulations. It doesn't always have to be rolled out universal. Sometimes it's rolled out in some kind of way that's not efficient to do it all at once. We could insert randomization into that process, roll it out county by county, randomly choosing the counties in the state, or what have you. I think there's a lot more opportunity for that than what we realize, so we should keep that in mind. But now on to the situation where we usually are. We're a situation of a natural experiment, because the legislature, a regulatory body, somebody else changed the law and did it in a way without random assignment. So then we have a natural experiment. Well, this whole notion of thinking about experiments is so important because I think epidemiologists, what we do a lot is we kind of incorrectly lump studies into observational studies, which tend to have kind of weak causal inference, and controlled trials, or RCTs, randomized controlled trials, that are strong in causal inference. And you see this in the Cochrane reviews and everything. I mean, there are a lot of meta-analyses. They'll just discard any study that's not a randomized trial. Well, a consequence of that is you discard a whole field of study, like public health law research, because of that criterion. So we're in a situation of creating natural experiments that are just as good as randomized trials. And what I'm going to submit is we can do that. And many times they're better than most randomized trials because they're not artificial or limited to a little laboratory situation. What we got to do is combine a bunch of design elements so that the causal interpretation, the plausibility of a causal interpretation of a treatment, an ostensive treatment effect of a particular law is so plausible, so strong that it cannot be denied, right? That's our game. So we have a whole toolbox of these design elements we can use. And when I look at the literature that still is happening today, many, many of those studies that are in our journals right now use one or two of the design elements, but they don't use a half a dozen others that would have been available to them if they'd only thought about it when they designed the study. So here's a few key ones. Many repeated measures in a time series. Well, let's just stop at that one. This is the most basic thing, right? So when I look at the literature right now, I see all these studies that have annual measures. You know, they take measures for a few years before the law goes into effect, compare it with a few years after the law goes into effect, kind of like the first panel there on the bottom, and you get a pattern like that. It's kind of hard to see whether there's any effect of that legal intervention in that case. And why they do that, I don't know. We all do it a lot because the website, CDC, publishes the annual data. It's easy. It doesn't take much work, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a better way to do it. If we get higher time resolution data, look at the panel on the right, it's easier to detect the effects of the law. First of all, they don't take effect on January 1. A lot of times it's July 1, September 1, July 20, some other date the law takes effect. So why not do it at that level of resolution instead of building in error right into your research design? And all the stuff that Scott talked about theory. Now think about what's the hypothesized theoretical mechanism for the effect of a particular law that you or I are evaluating, and how does that roll out? Is it a social process that evolves, and it takes 4 months for that message to get out? And do you expect a pattern of effect that's going to kind of curve like this? Well, then you need to measure it at that level of resolution in the data, and then see if it matches the hypothesized causal effect, not just lumping things all together to a year or whatever is easily available. And we can do that. So I mean, that's just one example. Let's go back to the other one. I talked about functional forms of effect. That's just what all the theory, that's where the theory and the research design comes together, right? That's this point, thinking through, how's the law rolling out? How is it being implemented? Is it a deterrent enforcement effect? And how is that going to roll out? What's that pattern going to be? Is it going to dissipate over time as interest wanes? How is the social norm going to change? How long is that going to take? Having that pattern and then studying it and matching it to the data. But then we got all this other stuff. So the next whole thing in the design elements are comparisons. Right? And what a lot of us do is, okay, we have state A passes a law, and we look for a similar state B, and we use that as our comparison. So even if we do good time series data, we get lots of measures, we look at our focal state that changed the law, and we compare it with one other state. Well, okay, that's all right. That's only the first little bit of using that design element of comparisons. First of all, we can do a lot better. We can have multiple comparison states, usually at a very low marginal cost to the study. You can compare them to all the other states. The notion of what's a similar state, but it's not just similar geography or similar. The scientific issue is you want the comparison to be similar in all the causes of the phenomenon, the outcome under study, and use that as a comparison. So, and we can do synthetic comparisons, creating, using propensity score methods. Lots of little advances to get better comparison state. But then that's just one, conceptually, one type of comparison. Then we can have comparison groups within the state. Laws frequently have differential effects or impacts or expected impacts on different groups within the state. If you pass some law regulating whatever, injuries in auto repair shops, well, you can compare the injuries in auto repair shops with injuries in other similar shops that are not subject to the new law, right? So it's within the same state, and you have that nested comparison, and then you have cross-state comparisons. So you can be thinking about groups in terms of their exposure to the law or their expected impact of the law and get an array of comparisons. And then comparison outcomes is kind of whether you call it a group or an outcome. I mean, in the road safety area, we compare daytime with nighttime crashes because they're different. The nighttime ones tend to be the drunk drivers, and the daytime ones tend to be the sober drivers or whatever. So you take different outcomes that are available data sets, but where one is clearly expected to be affected by a particular law and the other is not. Well, in addition to thinking about these different comparisons, we can also nest them all into one study and create a matrix, right? So this is just going back to the original work that I did when I started this stuff, evaluating the effects of the legal drinking age. Back in the 70s, 80s, states were moving from drinking ages of 18 up to 20 or 21. That kind of was the legal change that was underway at that time. That was kind of spreading and diffusing around the country. So those early studies, we took a couple of, quote, experimental states that raised the drinking age, like Maine and Michigan, and had comparison states that had maintained the drinking age. New York, that had 18 since Prohibition at that time, all the way through, and Pennsylvania, that had an age of 21 since Prohibition, all the way through up to that time of the 70s. But that's just the first level. Then within each state, we compared underage drinkers with the focal age group that were directly the target of the law, and with drivers over the age of 21. If this law is having an effect, you expect to only see it in the 18 to 20s, maybe a little spillover effect, smaller effect maybe in the underage drinkers, and no effect in the ones over 21 because the law didn't change anything for them. And then within each of those age groups, nested within the age groups, we can compare alcohol-related crashes with non-alcohol-related crashes. And then we can have multiple measures and compare police-reported drinking and nighttime single-vehicle crashes, because police-reported drinking might have just changed. The reporting might have changed as a result of the law, not the actual phenomenon. So you take care of that. So that's the idea of creating a matrix of design, having multiple comparisons at each level and then nesting them in. And we can do this for most of our legal evaluations, and it creates a very strong design. You track the health outcome for 100 observations before the law goes into effect and 100 observations or whatever after the law goes into effect for each cell in that kind of a research design. And then you have all those design comparisons. And if you find, like we did in the drinking age case, only the change in the states that changed the law, only for alcohol, only for the age group that was the focus of the law, only for alcohol related and not for non-alcohol related, even within the same age group, it's hard to argue that, well, it wasn't randomized, you don't have clear evidence of an effect of the law. And those studies have held up for whatever, 20, 30 years, because of that kind of a design thing. Well, my time's about up. I just want to make another comment about measurement infrastructure that I think is so important. For us to really build the field of public health law research, another thing we need is the data systems to do these studies. And if we're doing that with the independent variables, right? The independent variables are the laws. And we started doing that my team at the University of Minnesota, when I was there a couple of decade and a half ago, we started doing this for alcohol policy. And then NIAAA picked it up, and we have APIS. What we're doing now at Temple University with this National Public Health Law Research Program is we're building Law Atlas, and we have a website there for all areas of public health law. So creating empirical data sets of all these laws. So that's another whole talk in and of itself. But then you have the outcome variables, the dependent variables, all these behaviors and outcomes. And if we think what FARS did, FARS was created and then has run since 1975, and it led to a burst of studies, thousands of studies over the last 30 years, because that infrastructure was there. And we have to do the same thing with mediators and mechanisms. So here's the summary. You can read it yourself, and if you want more details, that's a quick summary of another one of the chapters in the book. There's lots of good stuff. If you have more questions, we can surely talk later after the session. Thank you.